Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic. That's what we've been discussing in the first hour. Robert Snow, my guest, stays with us this hour. We'll open up phone lines at the bottom of the hour. If you'd like to call in and have your own stories or questions for Robert, you can certainly chime in and be a part of the show. Later on, Tricia Robertson joins us. She is the past president of the Scottish Society for Cyclical Research, and her new book is More Things You Can Do When You're Dead. And she digs very deep into her extensive casebook to discuss a wide range of physical and mental phenomena, evidence, and things she believes proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that survival happens after death. That's what we have on tap for you this evening. So please stay tuned and keep with us. I'm Dave Schrader, your host this evening, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Good evening and welcome back to Coast AM. Robert Snow, my guest this hour. Robert, you have these experiences. You say you've walked through three different lifetimes during this regression. What was the total time that this regression took place? Was it 1 hour, 2 hours?
It was an hour session, but probably I wasn't in the regression more than a half hour because it took a lot of time working into it. Dr. Griffith went through a lot of visualization things before I actually went into what I would consider the hypnotic state. It was probably a half hour length total.
But that's pretty impressive that it took a half an hour to get you there, and then in a half an hour you were able to visualize and be a part of three distinct different life patterns and walk away with it to the point where you said even months afterwards, if you closed your eyes, you could still see the detail of the brush strokes of the painting that you had worked on.
And again, that's what bothered me, the vividness of it. And that's why I decided I need to disprove it. I need to prove that it was nothing but simply buried memories of this from this life. And that's why I thought I need to find one of the two paintings. If I can find it, I'll remember, oh, yeah, I saw that, you know, 5 years ago. And that explained everything. You know, this is nothing supernatural about this. You saw the painting, you forgot about it. So I had an idea. I would go to the Amherst Public Library on my lunch and go just start thumbing through art books. Again, I figured it wouldn't take that long to find them. Well, I had a couple miscalculations. Number one, the Indianapolis Public Library has hundreds of art books. And it took me months. It took me months. And I finally went through them all. And it took me months. But I didn't, because I did on my lunch hour. Then I started going on weekends when I'm on days off and looking. Because it was starting to bug me because I couldn't find them. I thought that they had to be fairly famous or I wouldn't know about them. I'm not any kind of art buff or art aficionado or anything. I don't know much about art. So I thought they had to be fairly famous. And it took me several months, and I went through every single art book in the Amherst Public Library, and I didn't find them. And I thought how odd that was. So then I thought, well, that's what I do. I started visiting bookstores around the Indianapolis, Borders, Half-Price Books, places, because they have art books, the library doesn't. And I started going there and looking through their art books. And again, it took a month or two, and I didn't find anything there. So finally, I thought, well, I'll start visiting some art galleries. I mean, I'll describe the paintings to them. I mean, sure, how many paintings of hunchback women could there be? So I thought I'd go visit some art galleries around the town here and see if they could tell me, where this painting's been, where it's at. Then I could find out where I saw that. But interesting enough, now this was pre-internet days. This was back in the early 1990s. And so I found something very interesting is in these days, there was no list of paintings anywhere. There was no, like nowadays, you could go into the internet and on a search engine and put hunchback woman painting and it pull up everything on it. And these days, there was no such thing. And every art gallery owner I talked to told me the same thing. If I didn't know the artist, the title of painting, and where it'd been at before, there's very little chance I could find it. And finally, after it was 7 months of searching and trying to find it, I finally had to give up. And I told you, I was in charge of the homicide branch in Annapolis for 6 years, and we had a very high, we had an 83% clearance rate, which is very remarkable for a city our size. But that still means every year 17% of the cases go unsolved. We just simply don't have enough evidence, and the case is not solved. And I thought, that's what's going to happen here. This case is not going to be solved. That's all there is to it. I don't have enough information or evidence to solve this case. And so I thought I needed to let it go and just forget about it. Well, that's easy to say, and I didn't. I kept thinking about it, but I couldn't think of anything else to do to prove this was just buried memories from this life. So anyway, it was getting close. A couple months after I gave up looking, it was getting close to our anniversary, and my wife and I were thinking about taking a trip somewhere on our anniversary in April, and she called me one day at work and said, what do you think about going to New Orleans? I thought, it was like fun. I had never been to New Orleans, neither did she. sound like fun. So we booked a flight. We booked a trip to New Orleans. So last April, we flew down to New Orleans, and we had a good, really good time. My wife's a history buff, so she drug me around to every historical site in New Orleans, which is tons of them. And every night, we go into the French Quarter and hear the bands and to go visit all the bars and everything. And I noticed every night as we go into the French Quarter, they're all kind of really neat shops in French Quarter, and historic memorabilia stores, antique stores, what have you. Of course, they were always closed at night when we went down to the French Quarter. So the last day we were there, our flight didn't leave till late in the afternoon. So we had the day to spend in New Orleans. And I told my wife, why don't we go window shopping in the French Quarter? We just go look at these stores. So we started doing that. We started going to antique stores and historical memorabilia stores. We finally got to Royal Street. Now, in the early 1990s, Royal Street was all art galleries. And so we went into them, and some of the art galleries just had some beautiful paintings by old masters and some of these paintings. But I noticed as we walked down, and we went from one gallery to the other, as we got down toward the end of the street, the galleries kept getting smaller and the paintings more obscure. Well, finally we get to a small gallery down at the end of Royal Street, and we walk in, and there's a sign, it's a two-story building, it says Modern Art Upstairs. My wife is a fan, I'm not, she is a fan of modern art, so she goes upstairs. So I'm walking along the first floor of the art gallery, just look at the paintings, and I didn't recognize any of the paintings, and certainly didn't recognize any of the artists. So I'm walking along, and I get to the corner, and there's a portrait down an easel. I just kind of give it a glance and walk by, and it's like I suddenly walked into a glass wall. I stopped so abruptly. I turned around. It was the picture of the Hunchback Woman. Let me tell you something. As a police officer, I was a police officer for 38 years, and I was in a lot of scary situations. I was in a lot of frightening situations. No matter what you see on TV or movies, believe me, police, you're scared at times. You really are. But the difference being, as a police officer, I'd had training and experience on how to deal with scary situations. I knew what to do, what the most likely reactions of the person I'm dealing with would be, and basically I had training experience to do. In this case, I had no idea what to do. I couldn't believe it. I'm standing looking, and after all these months of searching, you're thinking, what are the odds of months of searching you could just stumble onto this painting by accident after going a trip 1,000 miles away from you where you live? And I kept closing my eyes thinking, no, this looks like the painting. It's close, but it's not. But again, like I said, I could close my eyes, and I could still see the painting in the vision. And I opened my eyes, and I knew it was the painting. And then for a while, I kind of thought about maybe I wasn't really there. Maybe I was in a nursing home somewhere. I'd had some kind of stroke, and I just thought this was happening. Because I had no idea how to deal with this. I had no experience.
So to you, it made more logical sense that you were maybe in a hospital having a breakdown at this moment.
Exactly. I thought maybe I was in a mental ward or a nursing home somewhere, because this doesn't happen. Believe me, things like this happen in the movies. They happen on the X-Files on TV. They don't happen to people in real life. Things like this do not happen. And I didn't know how to explain it. And I just kept staring at the painting, staring at it. I was trying to find some rational explanation. How can this happen? How could you stumble onto this painting that you had seen, and your aggression just happened to be here? So yeah, I'm looking at this painting for 3 or 4 minutes, and apparently one day a salesman saw me. He thought, hot dog, you know, you must really. So anyway, all of a sudden I'm talking, I hear this man walk next to me. He says, I bet you're thinking nice I look over your fireplace, aren't you? And that kind of startled me. You know, I was still trying to figure this all out. And I realized maybe there's got to be some rational explanation for this. So anyway, I said, I don't recognize the artist. Who's the artist of this? Because I was looking for a signature. He said, hold on a second, I got a little bio over here. So he went over to his desk and pulled out this little bio, just a little paragraph. And the guy says that the name was J. Carroll Beckwith. And I started reading the bio, and it kept getting more startling, because there were little things in the bio that I had seen the regression. I saw, I think I saw 5 different things in the bio that I'd seen the regression. And again, it's one of these things, I didn't know what to do. I had never dealt with this situation before. And I knew there had to be a rational explanation for this. And it finally occurred to me what it is. I thought, I know it. I've seen this painting somewhere in Indianapolis or close around my home where I live at. There was a little blurb about the artist, and that's how I knew these things. That's all there is to it. I mean, finding it in New Orleans was one heck of a coincidence. Certainly one heck of a coincidence. But I still figured there had to be a rational explanation for this. So I asked the dealer, I said, I've seen this painting somewhere before. Has this been in an exhibition or museum or somewhere? He said, no, you haven't seen this painting before. He said, this has been in our private collection for years. He said, let me be honest with you. He said, Beckwith wasn't that famous. He said, I can let this go real cheap. And again, I didn't know what to do. I don't know. I'm just standing here stunned. It's funny, my wife came down from upstairs, and she was asking where to go. And I thought, yeah, I'm ready to go. But then I thought to myself, well, now I have more information. I had the information from the biography, the name. I had a date of birth, a date of death. I thought, I need to go back to Annapolis, go to the library, research this name. You'll remember where you see this at. It'll all come back to you. Everything will come back to you. I'd say there's nothing supernatural about this. Like, there's just not. I've seen this somewhere in this life. Research this J. Carroll Beckwith. You'll know where you saw it. So I go back to Annapolis, and I go to the library. Again, this is pre-internet days. You actually had to go. In those days, you couldn't just type something into a computer. You actually had to go to the library and pull books off the shelf. So I went to the library, and I went to the art section, and started trying to find stuff. And I found there was hardly anything at all on Beckwith. Very, very, very scant information. Some of the very large books on art should have a mention of him, maybe. Small books had nothing on him. And I was kind of discouraged and asked the librarian, is this all there is? And she says, well, that's all we have. She says, why don't you go up to the art museum library? They have a much bigger collection of art books. So I thought it was a good idea. So I drove up to the art museum on the north side of Annapolis and went to their library, and I told the librarian what I was looking for, and she found me some stuff about Beckwith. But again, nothing much more than what the library in Annapolis had, the public library had found. And I'm thinking, how bizarre, how can I know these things about him if it's all there is about him? But I know she did give me a book. It was actually a book on the painter John Singer Sargent, who was one of a very famous American painter. It turned out that he and Beckwith had gone to the same art school and had lived together, shared an apartment for 5 years in France while they were in art school. And I noticed the little anecdote said at the bottom, this had come from the unpublished diaries of J. Carroll Beckwith that are kept at Nash Cave of Design in New York City. And I also said there was another little footnote that said some of the information came from the unpublished autobiography of J. Carroll Beckwith against National Cave of Zion, New York City. So, but again, there was just nothing there. But there's no, and because I thought, you know, maybe I'd stumbled on information in the past about Beckwith, and that's how I knew it. But there was just so no information by him hardly at all. And I thought, well, you know, how bizarre. How could I stumble if I didn't know about it? So finally, I thought, well, what I need to do. Because this is really starting to bug me now, because even though the museum library didn't have much, they had a couple more things I found, just a little more information, and everything kept one more thing I'd seen in the regression. This is true, this is true, this is true. And so what I was really looking for at this time, I was looking for a disproving fact, because I still didn't want to believe this had any otherworldly or supernatural, you know, explanation. This was grounded in this world somewhere. I just had to find the explanation. So what I wanted to do, I wanted to find one or two things I had said during the aggression about the painter that weren't true. Because I could find something, because, for example, I saw him drinking wine. Now, if he was a teetotaler or drank whiskey, didn't drink wine, it would be true. I said that we didn't have children, my wife couldn't have children. If he'd had children, then it wasn't true. If I could find one or a couple of things that weren't true, then this is not a real memory. This is not the past life thing. It's nothing. Because if it's a real past life, you couldn't have a mistake like that. So what I did is I sent a letter off to National Cave of Zion asking how I could get access to their diaries. And I got a letter back from them saying that they, of course, they didn't let them out because they were very old and fragile, but that they had made photocopies of them, that I could get a photocopy on Aaron Library alone of the diaries. So I thought, good. What I need to do is get a copy of the diary, maybe the autobiography, find a couple of things about Beckwith that I said weren't true, and this is all just some jumbled up mess. It's not real memories. And so I ordered the microfilm. Well, unfortunately, when the microfilm came, Beckwith started his diary at age 19 and made his last entry just before he died at age 65, were about 17,000 pages of diary. So
yikes. That's a lot of research.
Yeah, I had no idea what to do. Yeah, but you go and keep the microfilm for 2 weeks, you had to send it back. So I thought I'd read his autobiography. Maybe that would tell me stuff. Unfortunately, he started his autobiography. He died in 1917, and he started a biography in the early spring of 1917. He was really sick just before he died, and he only got 20 pages done. So what I finally did is I finally decided what, because this is still really bugging me, because it looked like it had almost an otherworldly or supernatural explanation, but I knew it didn't. I knew I could prove it didn't. And so what I finally did is I had a hard copy made of the diary, all 17,000 pages. I sat down And I read every single page of his diary. Also, it took me well over a year, reading every night and on weekends. What I did though, when I ordered the microfilm, I went through my tape that I had made a session, and I wrote down everything that could be proved or disproved.
Right.
You know, example.
Totally makes sense.
Really
right.
Did somebody who is really important in his life die of a blood clot? Now, if a woman very very important had died by a blood clot, then this is not true. There's something wrong. If he had children, I say he didn't, then it's wrong. These kind of things. So I wrote down the list of everything could be proved or disproved that I'd said. I found there were 28 things I had said that could be proved or disproved by his diaries. So I sat down and started reading his diary. And it was really unsettling because I kept looking for the disproving fact. I kept looking, looking, and looking. But all you'd find every time is one more little thing. Whoops, nope, that's true. Whoops, no, that's true type thing.
And well, Robert, really when you're having this and you're going through it and you're reading, theoretically, your own words from a past life, is it triggering memories for you now? Or do you feel like, I've read this before, I know what's coming next? I mean, was it that clear?
No. Nope, not at all. And again, that's why I kept thinking to myself, this is not true. You're going to find a disproving fact. But I didn't. I found out, interesting enough.
But even that, I mean, if you don't find the disproving fact, the fact that you didn't feel like you were connecting with the information that was in there and it wasn't bringing about any memories, that to me would have made the skepticism even easier.
It did. I wanted to get rid of this obsession. I wanted to prove to myself this wasn't true. If I could find the one disproving fact, the one thing that wasn't true, then that would solve it, wouldn't it? That would take care of it. If I could just find a better example, if he had children, then that's wrong. This is not right. But it turns out he didn't have children. Because he said, I told Dr. Griffin, I said, we didn't have children. My wife couldn't have children. Well, it turned out, soon after he was married, his wife had a very, very difficult miscarriage. And because of it, they couldn't have children. And they didn't have children. I found he did drink wine. Interesting enough, because he makes a couple mentions in his diaries how odd men, a number of men think it's odd him drinking wine, because men did drink whiskey. But he developed a taste for wine in France. And, you know, he kept finding one thing after another thing after another thing. But finally, what really swung me the other way that maybe this does have a different explanation, when I finally got to December 5th, 1886, there were only two women in his wife, in his life, that I knew could be important enough that he would, you know, that he could feel that sad about because I'm dying of a blood clot. It was either his wife, Bertha, who he loved dearly, or his mother, who he truly, truly worshipped. His mother was the only person who ever encouraged him to be an artist. His dad always told him that being an artist is the best way he knew of starving to death. And he really tried to discourage him, but his mother encouraged him. He just loved his mother dearly. So finally, when I got to December 5th, 1886, Becca writes in his diary that his mother is in church and died of a blood clot, stroke caused by a blood clot.
Wow.
And I think that was probably the thing that probably pushed me over the edge, that thinking, holy smokes, you know, this is, you're not going to explain this out of this life, Bob, you're not. But it turned out, before I was finished, I was able to prove all 28 facts. I didn't find a single fact that I had said that wasn't true.
Truly amazing. Yeah, and we have to take a break. Portrait of a Past Life Skeptic, the true story of a police detective's reincarnation. Robert Snow, our guest. And we'll open up phone lines if you have questions for Robert regarding his story or his experiences. You can feel free to become part of the show. And when we return, what happened when he went to visit the gravesite of his past life? We'll find out about that next on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Snow, our guest this evening, as we discuss a case of reincarnation. As Robert found a connection to this past life regression, and every point he brought up during the taped regression matches identically with the information directly from the artist's own diary. Talk to me about the moment you went to visit the grave. What was that like, and what was the experience overall?
Well, actually, I went to New York. I was wanting to find anything that Beckwith had been involved with, you know, where he lived and this type of thing. And actually, the problem is he died in 1917, so everything he and most of the things he involved in New York save is gone. But I did find during research on him that he was buried just north of there in Valhalla, New York, in Kensico Cemetery. And I kept thinking when I was looking around New York for, you know, for information about where he lived and things he'd done, how neat it'd be to visit the grave. But I don't know why. It also give you a little stomach twinges too, you think. But I can think how silly it was. I mean, there's just a, you know, body in the, you know, in the grave been there since 1917. There sure could be nothing there because any spirit was in him is now in me. So anyway, I finally decided the last day I was in New York City, I took the train up to Valhalla, New York, and I went to Kensico Cemetery. And it's a huge, huge cemetery, beautiful cemetery, and beautiful. So I went up there. So I went to where Fiona's grave was, and it's kind of funny. As I found where his grave was, as I got closer to it, I had this terrible, terrible anxiety attack. When you're a new police officer, a rookie officer, and you get called into a really stressful, dangerous situation, you have different ways to react. Your heart starts palpitating, you start sweating. You know, I always had a problem. My left knee would start shaking when I went into a really scary situation. When I come a new officer, because as a new officer, you're not experienced, you don't know what to do, and it scares you. Well, it's kind of funny. As I walk closer back to that grave, I could almost feel my heart beating against my rib cage. I was sweating profusely. My left knee was shaking. And I couldn't understand it because, I mean, there's nothing to be frightened of here. It's just simply a grave. I mean, there's no, and again, there's no spirits or ghosts there. Any spirit was there is now inside me. And I couldn't understand it. But every time, as I stood close to the grave, the anxiety kept getting worse, and I couldn't get rid of it until I found if I walked away from the grave, it was gone. And if I went back, the anxiety attack returned. I can't explain it. I assume it means you're not supposed to do this. And I have no idea why. I assume you're not supposed to visit your grave. I assume it's not something your body, for some reason my body did not want to do this. And it was really a terrifying experience. And I have no idea why, because nothing happened there. Nothing happened to make it scary. But just approaching the grave gave me a terrible, terrible anxiety attack.
How did he die?
He had endocarditis, which is an infection of the heart valves, and he had a heart attack and died. He died real suddenly. And in fact, he didn't know he was. I mean, this was 1917, and they did an autopsy on him. They found he had endocarditis, and he'd had it for several years. If you read his diary, you can see if you read what the symptoms are, you can see the symptoms in him. But he didn't know he had it, and he was just suddenly died. He was out for a walk in Central Park and had his terrible chest pains and had his attack, and they brought him back to his apartment. And he died there at his apartment just an hour or so after he had the attack.
How interesting. Robert Snow tells us, you told us at the beginning of the interview that you'd always known since you were a little boy you wanted to be a writer, and here you are connecting with a past life who, although an artist, was a very fervent writer. He kept thousands and thousands of pages of journals and diary entries and even began his own autobiography. I mean, that's a pretty intense moment, too, to realize that maybe that's where your want and desire for writing came from.
Well, it's a more interesting twist than that. Beckwith, at the last life, because he had endocarditis, he couldn't stand up any longer for a long period of time, and so he couldn't paint. He couldn't paint the last year or two of his life because he endocarditis. He was very weak and couldn't stand up, and so he decided he'd become a writer instead. And so he actually had several number of articles published in various art critic magazines, and he decided to become a writer at the very last of his life, just before he died. And again, he had several things published. And I thought, I'm like you, I thought that was kind of interesting carryover.
Very interesting. We'll take your calls when we return with our guest, Robert Snow, here on Coast to Coast AM. We're back with Robert Snow on Coast to Coast AM. Have you done any genealogy at all, Robert? Is there any chance that you might be related?
Actually, it can't be. Beckwith, he didn't have any children. And
okay.
And so his wife didn't. And
but he didn't have any brothers or sisters or anything like that?
Yes, he had two brothers. And there was one of the brothers did have a girl, but I don't believe she had any children. And again, there's no connection I can find.
Certainly right.
Not to my branch of the family, no, at all.
Well, let's grab some phone calls here. West of the Rockies, Katie in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi,
Dave,
Katie.
And Mr. Snow. This is a really cool program that you have tonight. And
thank
I was
you.
Very interested to hear about your past life regression. I wondered, Mr. Snow, did you ever hear about a teaching or a book called Dianetics.
By Ron Hubbard.
Oh, Ron Hubbard,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No, yeah, I haven't read the book. I know about the book, but I haven't read it, no.
Well, you might want to pick that up if you can. You might can get it online. I don't know. I don't have a copy anymore. But Hubbard was doing a lot of research back in, I think the book was written in 1951. And he did a lot of research with people, getting them to try to rid themselves of body problems and misemotions and just different kind of stuff that they kind of wanted to shed themselves of that were plaguing them during their lives. And so in their, I guess you could call a regression, they would oftentimes find themselves looking at pictures in their minds because their eyes were closed, and they'd be looking at pictures that they couldn't relate to their current lifetime. So Hubbard had to conclude that after hundreds and hundreds of people that he was trying to help, and he regressed them and stuff, that there had to be such a thing as past lives, because they were all coming up with stuff that didn't relate to their current lifetime. So I read that book back in 1968, of all things, at University of California, Davis, sociology class that I was taking. And it was optional reading, but it sounded interesting to me.
Very
and it
cool.
really
Thanks.
Was. That was the precursor to Scientology. So you might be interested to read, you know, that aspect of regression.
All right. Thank you, Katie. We appreciate the call. Let's go wildcard line two. Bill, who's out trucking in Kentucky. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yeah. Hey, thanks. Hey, I've had this recurring dream for years now. And I'm 46. I mean, I've had this dream as long as I can remember, that I am an animal. And when I tell people that, they're like, oh, how exciting. No. These dreams are very boring. As a matter of fact, I kind of don't like it when I have them. And they, because it's not, you know, a human living as an animal. It is as an animal. I'm left with only three impressions. One is animals don't really have rage, but they do have heightened emotions. And I know most of it seems centered on fear. The second one is that our consciousness as a human is really not that, special. And the third impression I'm left with is the earth itself is very much alive. Then that's it. That's all I can remember. And like I said, other than that, they're very, very boring. And one is I'm a gliding mammal of some sort, and the other is I'm in a pack, like maybe some sort of... I'm thinking maybe like a pack of cetus, like an ancient, canine. But anyways, the bottom line is I'm wondering, would hypnosis get any sort of fidelity on that type of reincarnation, animal to human?
Well, thank you for calling in with that question, Bill. Are you aware of that at all taking place in any of the stories that you've looked into at all, Robert?
No, not at all. Again, the only really case I investigated was this case, my own case. And I've had a number of people, not just a question like this, but they asked me about different philosophical and theological implications of what I found, and I'm kind of in a tough spot there, because I was a cop and I was an investigator, a detective. That's what I did. I wasn't a philosopher, a theologian. And I really, people have asked me sometimes to explain what this all means, and that's really beyond my scope of my, what I do. Again, my job was investigation, and that's what I did in this case. But when it comes on to explaining what it all means or other parts of it, I really can't. I'm really at a loss for doing that.
Timmy D on Facebook wants to know, you went in and you had this regression. She, in a half an hour, basically brought you through three past lives by pointing you in a direction. Have you ever gone back in to see if there are more lives that you can uncover?
Yeah, I did, really. When I was doing my search for the paintings and I couldn't find anything, it was really frustrating because I couldn't find it. I thought they had to be somewhere. I went back to Dr. Griffiths for a second session, thinking maybe I could get more information about the painter. If I could get more information about the painter, then I would know where this information came from. It would explain everything to me. I thought I would find out I'd seen it where I'd seen it from. So I went back to Dr. Griffiths, and interestingly enough, even though I went back into the same hypnotic state I'd had before, every time she told me to get the artist's life, nothing had happened. I went back to three other lives I'd had, besides the three I'd went to the first time. They're all so far back in history, you know, you couldn't prove they're true or not true. The only way you could prove a life has to be fairly recent. But every time she told me to go back to the artist's life, absolutely nothing had happened. I wouldn't do it. And I asked her, Griffin, this over, you know, why? And she says, you already know everything you need to know. Which turned out to be true. At that time, I didn't think it was.
Interesting.
It turned out to be true. But I did have three other lives. One as a monk in the Middle Ages, and one as a teacher in ancient Greece, and once as a Chinese soldier. But they were all real far back in history. So, you know, again, you can't, is this really TV or movies coming back up, or is it really true? There was nothing in those lives, that you, like Beckwith, that you could verify dates and times and names and what have you.
All right, let's go to Wildcard Line 1, Carol in Georgia. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yes, just coming out on Coast a little while ago. I'm 69-year-old, totally disabled veteran. And what this gentleman has said has finally put the final dots connected in my life. I have been on so many narcotics for the past 45 years. Today makes 1 month and 1 day, and I am completely clean. My mind has opened up in the past 2 weeks. I've seen visions, if you want to call them that, all the way back to age 5 when I was a little child. I've had, I could say, ET visits, you name it, and it's all the whole nine yards. I know why we are on this planet. We've been recycled, recycled, recycled until we get it right. And you get it right by only one way. You must, no matter what you do in life, please, create more life than you either consume or destroy. I was a landscape architect. I propagated. I planted and planted more plants than hopefully I ever stepped on and killed. But I'm probably short on the stick. The same with animals. We don't need to eat animals, any kind of animal life. We're creatures of light. Light, but being that plants use sunlight to generate the food. We should all be vegetarians, consume plant life or plankton out of the sea. But the seas are polluted. We're killing our planet. Please, if anyone can hear what I'm saying, get out, meditate, pray, create love and happiness, and just plant seeds. I don't care if you throw out weeds everywhere. They at least.
All right, Carol. Life. All right. Thank you. I appreciate the insight on that.
I'm sorry, yep. I'm ranting and raving, but I am on a tangent. This man, thank you, sir, for saying what
thank you. Let's go to Wildcard Line 3, Elaine in Fort Myers, Florida. What would you like to talk about, Elaine?
Hi, there's just something always has bothered me about the term reincarnation. I just think that it's a misnomer term. I do believe in it, but not as the misnomer term that it's referred to, because we as in this dimension as humans think everything is on a linear progression where it's past, present, and future, but everything is supposed to be that there is no time and everything is happening all at once. So what is your opinion on that, where it's really not this linear progression, but it's all these lives happen all at once?
Well, the interesting thing is, again, that falls into the vein of theory, and nobody can tell us one way or another if that is something that's true. We can look at cases like Robert's, and he can go back and investigate the claims that he made and the connection that he made and find out if what he was connecting with was real or not. That's something tangible that you can investigate. But looking at is life and time linear, and are we living multiple lives at one time? I don't know that that'll ever be anything we can answer in this lifetime.
What is his opinion on that?
Right. Thanks for calling in. What do you think about that, Robert?
Again, we're talking about philosophical and theological questions. I'm not grounded in that background. So again, you're asking something that's beyond my training and experience.
Let's grab the last call we can here. First time caller, Ellis in Manchester, Tennessee. You have about a minute and a half.
Hello, I'm enjoying your program.
And thank you.
Dave and Mr. Snow. Mr. Snow, did you ever have dreams or visions or any kind of signs that of the past lives, like in conscious awareness or something like that?
Not before I had the regression. I had the dreams afterwards about the past life, but not before. Before, absolutely nothing had happened to me at all, zero. But after that, it was part of the obsession. A thing about this regression is I began having dreams about the regression, constant dreams about the regression was one of the reasons that made me decide to investigate this case to kind of clear my mind of it.
All right, east of the Rockies, our final call, Susan, trucking in Ohio. What did you want to say quickly?
Yes, I wanted to ask your person there.
Okay, quickly, we're running out of time.
If one wanted to do the regression, how would they go about finding someone to do it?
A good question. There used to be a number of organizations that they listed them. I would assume you'd have to call just a number of psychologists who do and see if they did past life regression. I don't think there is any more organizations that list people who do past life anymore, but I think you could actually call a psychologist and say, I want to do this. Do you do it, or do you know someone else? And they could refer you to someone.
All right, thank you. Yeah, Susan, if you look online, just look up past life regressions, and you will find a great list of those, and you could usually ask for referrals. That's probably the best way to go. Robert, thank you so much for joining us this evening and sharing your story, and we'll point everybody to your book, and please keep in touch with us as you find more information, and if you end up finding anything more about this, we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure. All right, stay tuned. When we return, we'll be going to Scotland. Tricia Robertson, our guest, more things you can do when you're dead. And what can you truly believe? Tricia Robertson, our guest. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, and you're tuned in to Coast AM.